maybe there shouldn't be one at the table or just two, because before, because there were four, but like have different types of people at the table for those 100%. Meetings. Anyway.
Well, I had a challenge, I'll say.
Yeah.
Because it looked like a win for Target. Like, you got this picture, you got to go promote it. I will say this about Rev. He invited me to join him on his radio show weekly, where we would talk politics and help me build a following. During my time at MSNBC, I think he tried to be helpful while I was there, and extended himself to me. So I appreciate that from Reverend Sharpton, and I just want to be very transparent about that. I also want to be very transparent about the fact that there is this perception that Reverend Sharpton is a leader in Black America. He is a leader, yes. There's a very tiny sect of Black America who follows the steps of Reverend Sharpton. I do not believe, or I won't say I believe, I know that he does not lead the masses as he once did.
Well, who does though?
That's my point.
Okay.
We are a leaderless movement, to your point. We're a leaderless movement at this point. There is no, you know, back in the day, pre-Twitter and, you know, Instagram, we had five to 10 leaders. And even all the leaders didn't get shine. You know, Dr. Dorothy Height was a member at that table. She did not always get her shine. Yeah. You know, there are a lot of women in the movement, Black women in the movement, who did not get the shine. Right. Of national leadership. So when you think of civil rights, who you think of? Dr. King and Malcolm X. That's the first two. And it's not really like that anymore. Well, there's a ton that we probably think of, but you know, you ask your average person.
Reverend Jackson.
Yes. Well, Reverend Jackson, though, was post, but I think they were Andy post civil post Jim Crow, post civil rights. Like they came up, like they were under the tutelage. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. But we could name 100, but I'm saying like this, the people you think of are Dr. King and Malcolm X, who had different approaches. Agreed. Stokely was under them and had an issue with, how they were leading. So my point is, cause a lot of people had comments about that. And I think, we do have leaders who are loyal to power, you know, and loyal to brand. And so I think by posting a picture like that, that people took that, like, what did you specifically get out of this meeting?
Yeah.
Did they write you or National Action Network a check? And even if they did, you know, like, whatever. I don't know what deal was struck. But those were questions and comments that people were asking. And I think to avoid that, to really be of the people, it does take employing some different tactics.
Yeah.
I don't think this is moving with ego. Y'all are telling me, you know, if you have an issue with someone's tactics, it might be ego. I humbly say I don't mean it in ego, but I'm open to you all correcting me if I'm wrong.
You know, the only thing, though, Tiff, here is... I feel like...
Angela's not crying, by the way.
I just have no voice. I'm sorry. I should talk quieter and it'll be more soothing.
It's sexy and waspy.
I know this is my Andrew voice.
Somebody's getting it on. Somebody's riding
Hey, everybody.
That.
I just want you to know.
Hey,
that's how Andrew normally sounds. But I was going to say, you know, I think that one conundrum that I do feel... And where I felt for Rev in that moment is there are whole conversations that are had and people make a decision off of what they see in the picture and develop a narrative. Mm-hmm. 'Cause all they have is what you said and the image. They don't have a readout from the meeting. And sometimes you can't really do that because you got to keep things moving. So I felt for him a little bit because there was a whole narrative that was shared based on that. Now, the part that I didn't feel for was if you didn't put it out.
Right.
Because there were several other civil rights orgs that had met with Target before and none of us knew.
Mm-hmm.
So as the story began to unfurl, it was like, oh, you, like, that's fine. I don't see anything wrong with that. But the masses don't always know that.
Right.
So I'm also curious to know, how much do we tell the people if we also can say, if we agree with Prince, that Black folks are the only one that put our whole strategy up on a website.
Mm-hmm.
What parts of this should we keep to ourselves while we allow the thing to unfurl in our favor? I don't know.
All of it. Until, like, don't the put deal the is done. Up either. Yeah, you don't.
You're saying keep all of it to ourselves.
At levels of movement shifting. So the call
was put out to the people, and the people have responded. Mm-hmm. For the 10th consecutive week, foot traffic down by over 9% in Target stores across the country. That has been since the start of the announced boycott, and they're backtracking on DEI. We know that there is an impact being had, because there would not have been a call to Reverend Sharpton or anybody else to come step foot at Target headquarters were this not landing in some way or another.
They met at NAN.
At NAN, which either or, doesn't matter. Because if the currency is, we all know this, a picture is worth a thousand words. Nobody knows it better than Reverend Sharpton himself. Nobody knows it better. Mm-hmm. What I have to believe is that there is a strategy that is not known to me and us that has to be underway, because I don't think Reverend Sharpton would have gifted what is a big piece of the currency for being at the table, which is the image that says a thousand words. Mm-hmm. And the midst of a protest that's been going on for 9 weeks rather successfully, here comes this new inflection. Why did it happen? It starts to chatter. It, you know, the company can use it any way they want, quite frankly.
Yes.
They can image that however they choose to. You stood for the photo. And now it can be used to suggest some things that may not have been right. But who read the fine line to determine that that wasn't right? So I just, all I would just say is,
what if he released it? I'm not saying this is true, but what if he released it before they did? Maybe they should have said no pictures allowed.
That's what I would have said. You don't get to use me as a photo.
Is there a reason why Jamal Bryan is not in a photo, or is he in a photo?
He's not in a released photo.
There is a reason why Pastor Bishop, as I call him, Jamal Bryan, is not in a published photo. Yeah. Because his understanding of the assignment was, we can see where we are. We should keep in touch mm-hmm. around how you all are moving back toward this commitment and these benchmarks. And so we've got to be in communication, open mm-hmm. discussion about that. But there will not be an announcement around us sitting down until there's an agreement to be signed.
Yeah.
There's no agreement. So.
There's none of that. There's right. nothing there, but there is a photo.
Native Land Pod is a production of iHeartRadio in partnership with Reason Choice Media. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
And now you know. Okay, as we move on to our next segment.
All right, folks, Tennessee Congresswoman Diane Harshberger, Republican, getting some blowback because she called, talking about Representative Al Green, called him a boy. Roll it.
It's been a long time coming for me, and it's an honor.
The people you serve want to see you. They saw me at the inauguration because we kind of forced our way into the front. That's another story for another day. But then they saw me at the State of the Union, too. And I saved that seat from 9:30 that morning. And who am I sitting across from? Al Green, that gets the first member to ever get ejected. I'm like, Lord Jesus, I was on front of every magazine from here to Knoxville. But
attorneys will get in a courtroom and they'll fuss and fight with each other. But as soon as it's over, they go out to dinner, have coffee, whatever.
Well, Lord Jesus, they make money that way. They get up and rant and rave and tweet or X or whatever it is. And
hold signs up during the state.
Now, that's not me. I wanted to go over there and grab a few of them, but Al Green was over here with his cane, and I'm like, gosh, dang it, boy. But that, he does not need that cane. That cane is a prop. I swear it's not real. And I'm wondering, one of my colleagues said, screw the gold part off of that. See if there's a gun in there. I'm like, I don't know about that man. He's just Weird Al.
First of all, she claims all the attention she got. Literally, y'all, I don't even know who the hell she is. I ain't never heard of this woman. I have never heard of this congresswoman. So, I don't know. You should be thanking Al Green, because the only reason we even mention in your country is because of what she said. Here's Congressman Al Green at a news conference.
Except for today to communicate. And there's also a reference that was made to my cane. I'll talk about all three of these, and then each person here will have an opportunity to speak as well. We're all going to try to be as brief as possible. But this is a topic that many people are very passionate about, both of these topics, meaning the slur on the LGBTQ plus community, as well as a slur on black men. Boy. This is especially sensitive for me because as a child, I remember my father being stopped by a peace officer, and the officer referred to my father as boy, and my mother was girl. And it wasn't just that one time. It was the way society addressed people of color who were of African ancestry at the time. It wasn't said to indicate that you were youthful. It was said to demean, to degrade, to denigrate. It was said such that you would know your place in society. And it was something that you would immediately have said to you. I can remember the child of an Anglo male calling my father boy, the child. My mother was called girl in the presence of her friends on one occasion. Friends, it's not about Al Green. It's about whether black people in this society are going to allow slurs such as this to be normalized. We cannot allow the normalization of these kinds of slurs.
Lauren, your thoughts?
You know, Tennessee, Roland. You ever notice how it's always Tennessee? I wonder why that is. You know the history, right? Tennessee. Here we go. And you're right. I had never heard of this member of Congress, and I cover Congress. So I was very surprised to see it. I was like, is that woman a congresswoman? You know, I'm glad Al Green is out saying something about this and that there are people still in Congress who do bring up and don't just sit there and not say anything when these things happen, because increasingly what we find is that nobody says anything. We're talking like racism is not disqualifying. That's just a fact. Racism in politics is not a disqualifying factor, as we found out last November. So I'm glad that he's saying it. He should speak out and speak up, and more Democrats have to join him. We seem to be the only group that never gets joined when something like this happens. And then we're expected to join other groups when stuff happens, you know, to them on their watch and this type of thing when it's something bigoted. So I'm glad he's speaking up. Al Green is a special character, and so good for him.
Yeah, it's always Tennessee, Rebecca. But how dumb? It kind of ain't real. That kind of ain't real. Rebecca, go on. See, they're going to make me cuss on this Wednesday. Go ahead.
Diana knew what she was doing. My great-great-grandfather was in, Henry Carruthers was enslaved in Tennessee. She knows what that means when she said boy, and she said it so casually and kind of just said it like she was saying something so funny, and it was trying to be coy. It's like, come on. Here's the other thing about Congressman Al Green. We shop at the same grocery store. I've seen him with groceries and using his cane. It's a mobility aid because he needs it. I would say that this would be beneath Miss Diana, but considering we really don't know what she does, we really haven't even heard of her. I mean, this just might, okay, cool. She got her 15 seconds. Al Green is a better person than her.
It's a little hard to be, it's something beneath her, Joe, when she already at the bottom of the barrel.
Right, exactly. First shout out to my family, Justin Robinson of the Houston Area Urban League. Saw him in the picture there, have to text him. But yeah, what's bad, it's not like she said, oh boy. It's not like she was above board and above level other than this slip up. She, to Rebecca's point, she's making a lot of personal slights. Oh, you know, he doesn't need his cane. And oh, you know, he's the only one to get thrown out of, you know, get thrown out of a State of the Union session, and all of these other things that have nothing to do with her and her constituents, frankly. And so, you know, that's what you're dealing with. And there's this problem with normalizing racism, and she did slide it in. She knew what she was doing when she said boy, because you know what? You or I can't be in certain rooms and slip up and say things like that. So she should be penalized for not saying that, for saying the wrong thing as well. But if you don't care, that's how you get down. See, that's what DEI is. Here's somebody, we didn't know nothing about her. She could have been in Congress for years. We don't know her from a hill of beans. We didn't know nothing about her until she had something to say about Al Green. Now, how impactful is she if you and I and we don't know anything about her? But maybe that's what the DEI is that they be talking about.
Diana Harshberger ain't nothing but a hillbilly from Tennessee. just a country bumpkin from Tennessee. It's as simple as that. And if you go to Memphis or Nashville, would nobody know who the hell she is?
Spot on. The comedians may be the ones that will always hold a beacon of light up. Speaking of one, we have Roderick Morrow, the black guy who tips. He's a writer, comedy writer, and an amazing podcaster, he and his wife. Sam J, hit that out of the park. I couldn't even argue. There was no
I mean, detected. I listened to it. I mean, first of all, I think it's very funny. I also think, like, dunking on the Democrats, crowd pleaser right now. Don't matter what side of the aisle you're on, everybody loves to hear something bad about the Democrats. But the thing, you know, the reality of it for me is, like, what the Democrats have to do is more complicated, and you do have to appeal to people's, like, higher selves. They don't really have a lane like Republicans have. Right. Bigotry is simple. It's very simple, and it doesn't need to be fact-checked or be true. They're eating the cats, they're eating the dogs. If that is going to make
ridiculous.
If that's going to make someone vote for you, there's not a thing a Democrat can say that will make you not vote for that person, because you just don't care. And that's, you know, I think the thing she said that was the most truthful and I mean, ironically, that made me laugh the loudest, when she was just like, they think too highly of Americans, but they still have hope and think we have our good people, and we're not. And I think that's the crux of that bit, you know. The rest is just about, like, Democratic messaging. And I don't know that there's a way to out-message this type of bigotry, because we don't necessarily have the same unifying causes in a big tent, right? It's a bunch of people kind of with their own cause, and then you tolerate everybody else's cause, even if it's not your cause. And man, it really seemed like people want to stop doing that. And that's sad, but damn.
Yeah. No, I mean, I laugh, but at the same time, every day we're fighting this. I want people to read. I want you to love reading. I'm going to do everything in my power. I want you to read to your children. I mean, listening to, you know, being here every day, it's self-preservation too. Like, we should want to call people to her higher self. This is the whole thing, right? So I'm not quitting, even though she's absolutely correct. Right. And it's the argument that I've been having off mic, low key, with a lot of people, people you may know, you know, about running for office and all this other BS. It's because they're dealing with the current construct, which is, we are, as a group of people, as a nation, I'm not talking about me and you, as a nation, we are low vibrational, knuckle dragging ignoramus. Mm-hmm. Latin. This is what we are. We are in idiocracy. We are low vibrational hopes. We are those. We are just one notch above Neanderthal as a group, as a nation, as the United States of America. Because you don't get 74 million people to show up to vote for this nonsense unless their vibration is so
and
low.
You have that to, unfortunately for politicians, and this is why I'm so thankless on the Democratic side, you have to run in the environment that it is. But on the Democratic side, you also have to sell what it could be.
Yeah.
So you don't get to just tell people, because you know what the simple message is to win, but everyone rejects it? I'm not Trump. That's the simplest message. It's not complicated. You ain't got to do a whole lot of reading. But people reject that message. They don't like that. Give me some hope. What's your plan for the economy? Well, that's going to be some reading, fam. Can't put that in a headline. You know, it's going to be deeper when we're going to give you a $20,000 mortgage credit. You got to do, oh, that's too much reading. I'm just going to stick with the man talking about them. It's just like, damn, man, we are cooked as a society when we, and so low key, I kind of, maybe it is bad, but I just don't think Democrats should give up on that. Cause I think after that, you don't have a message. Like, not one that anybody wants to support is just, guys, I'm going to keep it simple with you. You know, like, people are okay, what's the plan?
Do you think we've hit rock bottom? Because I feel like people had to bust their lip, face on the asphalt, you know, catch measles, do all the things. They had to do all, and they were like, all right, I get it now. Hand me a book. What I got to do? I got to read? Okay. All right, it's too much. Yeah. I lost everything. Okay, give me a book. Is this the pathway? My mind's going to be open. Okay. I feel like, have we hit, I don't know if we've hit rock bottom though.
We haven't hit rock bottom yet, but the suffering is going to keep continuing. I don't know when we'll hit that inflection point, but that's, I don't want it to be this way. I know whenever I talk like this, people give me a comment on social. Oh, really, man? I don't think. I hear what y'all saying. This is the only way I've seen it work. Everything I've ever read, this is the only way it's ever worked. Especially in this country that is addicted to white supremacy. It's got to, the shovel got to hit them. They got to step on the rake. It's got to hit them. And then they go, oh, man, you know what? Hating black people not this important. That, unfortunately, that's just how it works. I don't know why they're addicted to it. It's not really my issue to solve. They need therapy, not me. But Reconstruction, civil rights era. I mean, you had people in this country that women couldn't vote because they, you know, because they were more worried about whiteness than they were worried about aligning with black women to go get the right to vote. Like, this is a weird country with a bunch of messed up hangups. So it's always taken like a depression. It's taken the Iran-Contra affair plus a president going senile plus blah, blah, blah before they like, man, maybe we don't go that way anymore. You know, it takes economic crashes is when you see things change. Even with the Civil War, man, they took most of the capital of America, which was black people and slavery and cotton and stuff. And it was like, we finna make our own country. And it's like, I guess we'll have to do something. Like, it's not like this is not a, I don't know that you can ever take any point in time and truly say America is a good country built off of good, well-intentioned people. We've just happened to be on the right side of some stuff in the past.
Well, they brought good intention people, and they were already good intention people, community-based people here already who have the momentum of memory.
And I say this because we are not engaged in a struggle with a multi-billion dollar conglomerate because we hate somebody in the company. We are not choosing to take a moral position against this company because we have a personal vendetta against the CEO. We are engaged in this epic struggle to push back the greedy hands of corporate power and political cowardice because of the disingenuous notion that many feel as if that without lip gloss, they have to kiss the ring. We are engaged in this battle because you don't get to walk away from your public commitments to black people and think there will not be consequences and repercussions. None of these companies would think for a moment to do how they have handled us would they do to the Jewish community. How they have handled us is not how they would handle the Asian community. They are doing it because they believe they can get away with it. We are engaged in this battle because we understand that your word has to mean something. This company should have been serious in 2020. And if they were not serious in 2020, then they should not have opened their mouths in the first place. When it is that George Floyd was killed, the CEO and president of Target, under no political pressure, made a bold proclamation that George Floyd could have been one of his employees. And as a consequence, he wanted to stand beside the family and the community. We didn't ask Target to make a promise to black people. They did it out of their own will and out of their own volition. In 2020, Target was the one who came to us and said that they were going to spend $2 billion with black-owned businesses by 2025. To be clear, we didn't ask them to do it. They volunteered. It was Target who said that they pledged to support black nonprofit organizations and to fund scholarships for black students to the tune of $100 million. We didn't ask Target to do it. Target said they wanted to do it. And it was Target who said that they were going to increase black representation within their workforce. According to a CNBC report, Target promised to increase black representation in their workforce by 20%. And according to Forbes magazine, they pledged to give $10 million to social justice causes, and thus far, they've walked away from all of it. So let's be very clear. I want you to understand, Target board, CEO, and staff, that opening a store in the Black community is not an investment in Black communities. Opening a store in the Black community is just another opportunity for you to make money. Nobody in America spends more money than Black people. To our own detriment, I do not say that with a badge of honor or with pride, but we are the nation's lead consumers and embarrassingly least producers. We are the engine that moves the infrastructure of the consumer economy in America. If they want to sell anything, they've got to put a Black personal empowerment. Is not knowing how to balance a checkbook. We need to know how to have access to capital to get businesses off the ground. Something is amazingly, I always without fail get a loan to get a used car, but cannot get a loan to build a new house because of what is going on in America. During the summer of 2020, when George Floyd was murdered in Minneapolis by a white police officer, Target claimed to have seen the light. But now, 5 years later, there seems to be a lunar eclipse. And the insulting part is that they want to put all of us in Ray-Ban sunglasses. They expected nobody to care about breaking the promise to Black people, because America is used to doing that. They said they won't mind. They are just accustomed to the trauma of broken promises. We promised 40 acres and a mule, and we gave them Section 8 housing and a bus pass. We promised if they would fight for democracy and fight in our wars, that they could come back home and find themselves treated with decency, and your fathers and brothers and uncles still could not take advantage of the GI Bill. Because in their minds, respecting Black people is not something America ever has to do. In their minds, respecting the Black community is not a matter of financial life or death.
According to a study by the National Humanities Center, by the start of the Civil War in 1860, there were more than 46,000 plantations or estates with at least 20 enslaved people functioning across the South. 46,000. There were roughly 3,000 plantations with more than 100 enslaved people. Today, hundreds of these sites remain as private homes, wedding venues, bed and breakfasts, and tourist attractions. Many of them romanticize or sanitize their version of history as a part of the antebellum South. There's only one plantation museum that exists today that focuses solely on the experiences and the stories of those who were enslaved. That is the Whitney Plantation. Since 1752, the Whitney Plantation has gone through a series of evolutions. It began as an indigo plantation where at least 20 enslaved people from West Africa were forced to produce indigo dyes. The estate later grew into a massive sugar plantation with over 100 enslaved people working the fields and carrying out physically demanding work. Even after the Civil War, even after the Emancipation Proclamation, many former slaves remained on the same plantations. With no money, no land, and the threat of violence from their former enslavers, many former slaves had no choice but to stay as sharecroppers. These systems that entrenched deep poverty left many descendants of enslaved people with few options. At the Whitney Plantation, some Black families labored on the land well into the 1950s and 60s. Today, the Whitney Plantation Museum is dedicated to telling the histories of the people who were enslaved there, to honoring the lives lost, and the lives stolen. The museum honors the skill and culture of those who lived and labored and resisted against the systems that kept them from their true freedom. In the words of the executive director of the Whitney Plantation, the museum is, quote, in the long fight for justice, for truth, and for memory. Yet the Trump administration's focus on eliminating diversity, equity, and inclusion from American life has been sweeping, targeting funding for government programs, for schools, for museums, for anything related to race, gender, or economic equality. The president threatened to cut funding for any school that maintained what he called discriminatory equity ideology. It's not even a thing. And his administration cut funding from multiple museums that focus on non-white American histories, particularly programs and museums that focus on Native American and Black history. Earlier this month, the Trump administration announced funding cuts to the Institute of Museum and Library Services that included two grants that were intended for the Whitney Plantation Museum. The agency said that the museum and the programs that the grants were meant to fund no longer aligned with the agency's priorities and did not serve the interest of the United States. Now, let's be very clear about something. Telling the full history of this country is absolutely in our best interest. And what is not in our interest is erasing Black American foundational history. Joining me now is Dr. Imani Perry, professor of African American studies at Harvard University and bestselling author of multiple important books, including her most recent Black and Blues, How a Color Tells the Story of My People, and Tracy Terrence Farrell, executive director of Insight Network Incorporated Nonprofit Foundation and author of Life on the Whitney Plantation, 100 Years After Slavery. Tracy, you are someone who literally wrote the book and has a deep and personal connection to the Whitney Plantation. You and your mother co-authored the book, Life on the Whitney Plantation. It tells your mother's story where she was born and raised on the Whitney Plantation. Can you tell us a little bit about her journey?
Sure. First of all, thank you all for having me on the show. I am such a fan of your forward-leaning special program, and it's an honor and pleasure to be here. With the book, my mother, Vernita Gillard, and I, we decided to write this history of our family that lived, worked, and some that tragically died in the harsh conditions of Whitney Plantation. First off, to commemorate their resilience and strength. And secondly, because the plantation was turned into a museum, we wanted to have that history documented at this plantation museum. It is very important to us because not only is it our family history, this is history that's happening now, not in the antebellum period. We're talking about my family that's not even one generation removed from a slave plantation and all they had endured living there and working there.
So, Dr. Perry, for so many people who are looking at this and thinking, well, slavery was a long time ago. Why are we still talking about this? Why does this have to be a part of the history that we learn? Can you connect the dots in such a way that impresses upon our audience members the significance of what it is to erase the history of foundational Black people in this country from the story of America?
Right. I mean, first of all, I'm so grateful to be with you and also so grateful for the testimony that Tracy offered, because I think she actually explained precisely the point. We cannot actually understand the story of this nation without the story of Black Americans. History can potentially be a moral instrument. It can be something that allows us to look into the past, understand both the virtues and the vices that give us information about how we ought to conduct ourselves in the present moment. We know all of the wealth of the United States has some in the antebellum period was centrally connected to the unfree labor of Black people. On the Whitney Plantation, part of what you see is not simply the impact of generations of exploitation and unfreedom, but you also see the incredible body of knowledge, of skill that was required of people who were enslaved. You can see, I mean, to go through indigo and sugar and rice, and it teaches about all of the different kinds of farming that took place there. And that really is the story of the country. And I'm afraid that part of what this administration is trying to do is not just erase parts of history, but actually to erase the very idea of history and knowledge in the service of mythology. And you have to wonder why they are so desperate to have a public that is not informed, that is not knowledgeable, and that can't actually figure out where we come from as a part of how we decide about where we ought to go in the future.
Tracy, you gave such a moving account of the reason why you and your mother were motivated to put this book together. When you meet people and you are having conversations, particularly within the context of what's going on today, what's the most important thing that you try to convey about her legacy and what it represents in terms of the larger story of Black Americans in this country?
Well, like Dr. Perry just mentioned, it's a historical device here that we have. I try to convey to people this tragic situation, as sad as it was, it also brings immense strength and pride in me and my family that we were able to persevere and be resilient in these harsh conditions, and at the same time, as a people, be able to contribute to a massive wealth, as Dr. Perry highlighted, a massive wealth brought to the economy of Louisiana and also in turn to our country.
And when you have these conversations, do you find, Tracy, that people are surprised? Do you find that people are ignorant to some of this information? What is the reaction when you tell the story, not just of your mother, but of the Whitney Plantation as a whole?
Yes, I think you hit the nail on the head, sir. When I tell people about the situation or the history, they say, are you for certain? Your mom was in the antebellum period? I'm like, no, this is happening now in our generation. That's why the title is Life on Whitney Plantation, 100 Years After Slavery, which you can find at the whitneyplantation.org site. But yes, they're shocked. I even had one younger cousin at a university in a seminar, one of his classes, they talked about plantation life. And he said, oh yeah, my grandmother lived on that plantation. And the college professor, the students, they said, are you sure? The same thing I get. Are you sure we're talking about the antebellum period? He's like, no, she was one of the last of the families to live on this plantation this day and age. So people are shocked to hear that, my grandmother, who was one of my best friends, watch her mother die in child labor while giving birth in those impoverished conditions on that plantation. Yes, this is stuff that was happening this day and age. And usually I tell them, you see some narratives of what occurred, all the dastardly mistreatment of enslaved people during the plantation life, but you don't read about sometimes what were the ramifications of that on their descendants. So I aimed, and my mother aimed, to capture that in this book.
Picking up on that very point, Dr. Perry, what Tracy talked about in terms of the ramifications of descendants, is something that really strikes to me as the crux of the matter. In order to understand structurally how these things have had an impact on things like economic inequality, generational poverty, and other sort of constraints, even environmental racism, for example, when you don't tell these anecdotes and connect them to these systems, people are not able to understand the lingering impact and effect. But in your opinion, when you see these attacks, is that partially the point or the intent of why there's such an effort to erase this history?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, this is, when we talk about Louisiana, we're talking about Cancer Alley. When you have a history of devaluing people, one of the consequences is that then all of the suffering in our society is distributed in ways that allow various kinds of injustice to accumulate in certain populations. So absolutely, there is a discourse that implies that the efforts to address the history and the ongoing impact of racial inequality is somehow racist in and of itself, which is just, I mean, beyond wrong. I mean, it's horrifying to suggest that when you have generations of people who at first have their labor, the value of their labor go to others, and then for generations after to be exploited, and then literally within You know, I'm 52 years old. It's within my lifetime that is the first steps that we're moving towards addressing generations of that kind of inequality, generations of that injustice, and that now people are suggesting that somehow that effort to address that inequality is unfair. You know, it's horrifying. And we also continue to see the lingering impact, and in some instances, it's an echoing and it's a vast impact of generations of inequality on health outcomes, on education outcomes, on opportunities of various sorts. So yes, they are absolutely trying to distract from that fact, but also trying to teach a false narrative about what this country is and has done so that people will be completely confused, both inside and outside our community. So I'm so grateful that we're having this conversation because it has a large potential impact.
A large potential impact indeed. Perhaps one of the most important conversations that we will have all day, if not for longer. Thank you both, Dr. Imani Perry and Tracy Terrance Farrell, for being here.
NFL coach's son pulls a cruel prank on NFL draft prospect, Deion Sanders' son. All right, so we know who did it now. Here it is.
Hey, is this your dude? Hey, this is Mickey Loomis here, the GM of the New Orleans Saints. How you doing? This is Mickey Loomis here, GM of the Saints.
How you doing?
Good, how are you, man?
Good, we're waiting on you.
Yeah, we have. It's been a long wait, man. We're going to take you as our next pick right here, man.
This ain't going to be nothing to do.
Hey, but you're going to have to wait a little bit longer, man. Sorry about that.
What does that mean?
What? What do you say?
I don't know.
Are you going to ask us what it means and you was on the phone?
You heard that? You said you're going to have to wait a little bit longer. Okay. Sorry about that.
We have the full update. Put it a full mask. You see, only certain people, just a handful of people, had access to that phone number for a very specific reason. So things like that would not happen. So the man who prank called Shador Sanders, the son of Deion Sanders, over the weekend, as he eagerly awaited a call from an NFL team, has been identified now as the son of Atlanta Falcons coach. His name is Jax Ubrich. We have the footage, you just saw it, of them making the prank call. Now, according to ESPN, the Falcons acknowledged Sunday afternoon that the defensive coordinator left contact information for the quarterback accessible in his home. That's a no-no. Jax Ubrich, 21, came across a phone number of Sanders and saved it. He later used it to pose as someone with the New Orleans Saints as Sanders waited to be contacted by a team. So the prank call came as the former Colorado quarterback slid further and further down the draft board. The Falcons issued a statement, quote, earlier in the week, Jax Ubrich, the 21-year-old son of defensive coordinator Jeff Ubrich, unintentionally, I'm going to circle that word right there, unintentionally came across the draft contact phone number for Shador Sanders off an open iPad while visiting his parents' home and wrote the number down to later conduct a prank call. That's just the first sentence. There's more. Jeff was unaware of the data exposure or any facets of the prank and was made aware of the above only after the fact. The Atlanta Falcons do not condone this behavior and send our sincere apologies to Sanders and his family, who we have
been in contact with to apologize to, as well as facilitate an apology directly from Jax to the Sanders family. We have also been in contact with the NFL and will continue to cooperate fully with any inquiries we may receive from the NFL League office. We are thoroughly reviewing all protocols and updating if necessary to help prevent an incident like this from happening again. I want to take us back to that first sentence. It says, the 21-year-old son of defensive coordinator Jeff Ubrich unintentionally came across the draft contact phone number. So you are in the position to judge intention now. Who told you they unintentionally came across it? To me, that is a liability word. You're trying to dissuade from the reality of liability, because if the son did it intentionally, that means that there's a standard of libel, there's a standard of liability, excuse me, connected to what he has done, because it was in fact malicious. But if he unintentionally came across the information and decided to just say, oh, wow, yes, this will be a great opportunity to do a prank call. No, that sounds like intention. As a matter of fact, it sounds like premeditation. I don't know too many people who will run up on a random phone number of somebody in such a serious position with a dad who happens to be an NFL coach, understanding his dad's job and how serious this day is, for him to just say, let's do a prank call. Once again, sounds premeditated to me. So Jax publicly apologized to Sanders in a statement via Instagram on Sunday afternoon. The 21-year-old wrote on Friday night, I made a tremendous mistake. Shador, what I did, I'm so glad you're all on first name basis, by the way. Shador, what I did was completely inexcusable, embarrassing and shameful. I'm so sorry I took away from your moment. It was selfish and childish. I could never imagine getting ready to celebrate one of the greatest moments of your life, and I made a terrible mistake and messed with that moment. Thank you for accepting my call earlier today. I hope you can find in your heart to forgive me. I mean, what is there to forgive, sir? They said you did it unintentionally.
Want effective treatments for ED, hair loss, weight loss, or mental health?
All right. Social media obviously had plenty to say about the incident. Reactions? Here it is.
He didn't stumble across it. He's 21 years old. Okay, he found the number. He wrote the number down or saved it.
Here's what a publicist thinks of Shador in the NFL draft. We're going to call a spade a spade. The most offensive thing that Shador can do is have the audacity. He has no violent offenses, no charges, no drugs, no scandals. Because he's young, black, comes from a family that doesn't need money and is unapologetically taking up space, he's all of a sudden an issue, a fit problem. Have you seen an NFL locker room? The rhetoric around him needing to tone down or not shine so bright. Shador Sanders coming in is no more abrasive, aggressive, dominant, assertive than any other one, especially at the QB position.
There is nothing funny about what happened to Shador Sanders. A lot has been said about the draft pick and why he wasn't picked before, but there's a reason why he may have thought he was going a lot earlier than the fifth round.
You've all heard the problems of Johnny Manziel, right? Like, sure, the kid likes to party and hit the slopes every once in a while, and sure, he's making extra money on the back end by signing signatures that he's not legally allowed to sign. But have you guys ever thought that he is still a good kid? Shador Sanders. Yeah, you know, the kid has not been in any kind of legal trouble at all, and every program he has went to has gotten exponentially better when he's on the team. But he's a little bit too confident, and I'm afraid that we're going to have to knock him down a peg, so.
Yep. And, Sage Steele just wants people to stop bringing up race. Here it is.
So Shador Sanders fell in the NFL draft because of racism. I should have known that somebody would pull the race card, and I think it's just a pathetic take. That's just my opinion, though. here are some numbers, some facts. If you care about facts and the truth right now, that might interest you. I did some homework. It's not that hard, you guys. Last season, 15 of the 32 NFL starting quarterbacks were Black. That's about half, right? That's racist. How about the top 15 NFL players as far as money, payment, what they're making, salary? Dak Prescott, the highest paid player at $60 million a year. That's racist. And of the top 15 paid players, 9 are Black or biracial. 9 of the 15, making a combined $448 million a year.
Nice try. I like the pivot opportunity there. We're talking about what happened to Deion Sanders' child. Okay. All right. Sanders did not publicly comment on the prank, was selected in the 5th round by the Cleveland Browns. Will have an amazing career. Good luck to you. Godspeed. All right. Ricky, thoughts here?
Yeah. I'll let you deal with Faye Steele. I'm glad that I started back watching ESPN after she left. Anyway, but I feel like Stephen A. Smith said this morning, that the kid needs his ass whipped by his dad, or just a nice pop upside the head, because it was very disrespectful at a very intense moment. Every single Black person in the country was waiting on him to get drafted. It's a serious issue, and it just felt racist. It felt like the timing was bad. It felt like you added insult to injury. Whatever, you know, we can get into all of the other stuff, but I'm just talking about specifically what he did. And then the other thing is, Shedeur Sanders' his name, likeness, and pictures out there. Where is the kid's picture? Why did nobody post pictures of him and what he did or whatever, you know? So now he got to sit there on campus somewhere, afraid to come out of his dorm because Black Instagram just wasn't happening. And then how do you unintentionally come across Shedeur cell number? And I thought it was very disrespectful. And it's just some of the behavior, some of the stuff that we as adults have to put up with. And it started out with little stuff just like this that other people call cute, or boys just being boys. But it's a problem when we do it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. 100%. So we will see if there's a statement at any point. And I encourage them to just continue to move on. We got this part.
It was easier to change the world than to tell our grandmothers that we couldn't. We gave your generation an unsegregated world, but not an unracist world. I think it's important to know who you do your duty to or for. You're never dead until you're forgotten. You can't let the fact that a bunch of fools and Nazis are going to be running the country for a while. You have to still find some joy. And that's, Black Americans are incredibly lucky that whatever religion or whatever it is that means to us, we always still find some joy.
Remembering Andy Bay. Betty came by on her way, said she had a word to say about things today. About the plan. to blow away. Or maybe stay, she wouldn't say. For when she thought of summer rain, calling for her mind again, she lost the pain and stayed for more. Gonna see the river man, gonna tell him all I can about the man. It's meant for me.
Listening to The Sound of Language on WRCT Pittsburgh, produced by the students in Contextual Practice Seminar. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in the show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily express those of WRCT Pittsburgh or its members.
Concrete. They do a good job of making it look
real.
Yeah. It's so faux. Wow.
Hello, this is artist Ginger Brooks Takahashi. Last week I took my class, Contextual Practice Seminar, on a walk from campus down into Schenley Park. And we were going to see my permanent public artwork, Drip Seep Run. And we walked out of Hall of Arts.
I am noticing ginkgo nets on the ground. Crunching the paper.
I came out here with Britt Branson's class. Mm-hmm. My like first few weeks at CMU, mm-hmm. and we watched a bug for an hour. We had to find a bug and then
fun.
Follow it, and then if we lost it, had to find another one. Keep going.
That's a great assignment.
Down Tech Street to Schenley Drive, and so you'll hear the sounds of us walking on the sidewalk and noticing different things along the way. I had the students read two different texts in preparation for this site visit. So one of the texts is called Notes for Noticing, and it's a piece that I wrote with my collaborator Dana Bishop Root as General Sisters. And we created this in 2021, and it was for a show at Tufts University. Notes for Noticing is an invitation for moving and observing in a place where you have been before, to connect with knowledge that is part of your histories, your feelings, and those that are with you. Place yourself in the place where you are. with all that you are, connecting with the knowledge that is part of your history in present tense. Collective knowledge, collecting knowledges. Who is with you? Where were you the last time you were moving through